Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is irrevocably devoted to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today is another exceptional opportunity to interview an incredible person. She's interesting, she's informative, she's inspirational. And by the way, as we get into the podcast, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe, rate, review, it helps a lot. The book that we're going to be talking about today, let me introduce the book first and then the guest. It's called Priests of History. The subtitle is very interesting as well, Stewarding the Past in an Ahistoric Age. And let me mention that for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth, this book available. You can get it on the web at equip.org, equip.org. You can also write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Well, the author of this book is an incredible person. I mean, just reading her testimony in the book made me salivate over the opportunity to interview her on this podcast. Her name is Sarah Irving Stonebreaker. She's a professor of history and Western civilization in Australia Catholic University in North Sydney. I was just in Australia a couple of weeks ago, and I know that Sarah is basking in sunshine while I'm in a place where I can see snow outside. She is currently co-editor of the Journal of Religious History. She received her PhD in history from the University of Cambridge. She held a research fellowship at the University of Oxford. She converted from atheism to Christianity while an assistant professor at Florida State University. Towards the end of the podcast, I want you to hear her testimony. It's incredible. Her first book, a book titled Natural Science and the Origins of the British Empire, won the Royal Society of Literature and the Gerwood Foundation Award for nonfiction writing. Sarah and her husband live in Sydney, Australia. They have three children. I have 13, Sarah, so I've got you beat by just a few. But we're going to be talking about her latest book. It's titled Priests of History and subtitled Stewarding the Past in an Ahistoric Age. And I want to start, actually, Sarah, and welcome to the podcast, but I want to start by asking you about the import of the title of your book, Priests of History. It's an intriguing title, and I love titles. I've written over 20 books myself, and good titles is what capture the imagination of people and cause people to read books.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much, Hank. It's so wonderful to be here and to talk to you. Yeah. So the title of my book is actually one that sort of reflects quite a deep kind of personal way of thinking about history and also, of course, about my faith. So Priests of History encapsulates the fact that when as Christians we think about the past, I think that we're actually called to do a kind of priestly work in the very New Testament sense. You know, we're called to be a royal priesthood. And as Luther, you know, paraphrasing the first letter of Peter there, you know, priesthood of all believers. And what I think that means is, in relation to history, is that we're actually called to tend and to keep the past, to steward the past for God's glory. And so Priests of History kind of encapsulates that idea. But I guess the kind of broader sense there too is that I think now that's particularly important because we're living in a cultural moment that I call this ahistoric age, because I think increasingly in society, and I also think to some extent these ideas of ahistoricism, a kind of rejection of history, thinking that history is irrelevant, they do sometimes, I think, creep into the church as well. And so I think it's even more important to have this kind of idea that actually Christians are called to steward the past, to be a kind of a priest of history, tending and keeping the past or stewarding it in an ahistoric age for God's glory.
Yeah, so how does that impact the Christian church in a meaningful way? I mean, there are consequences to being ahistoric, and those consequences have a profound impact on the historic Christian faith.
Yeah, that's right. Well, perhaps it'd be helpful, actually, if I just kind of briefly outlined what I mean by this kind of ahistoric age, this kind of cultural moment that we live in. Because basically, this is a sense that I think, particularly in the last 10 to 15 years, this strikes me not only as a Christian, but also as a, obviously, as an academic historian, that we're now living in an age which is kind of, I think, uniquely ahistorical. And what I mean by that is, there first of all tends to be this sense, because of the kind of radical individualism of our culture today, and this kind of sense that we have that the good life is about just relentless self-invention, finding and being my true self and expressing that to the world. First of all, there's this kind of sense that, well, if that is what the good life is, that there's that the only story I have is my own, as it were, then history is just irrelevant to that project. So that's kind of the first thing I think that broadly, culturally speaking, is going on in the broader culture. The second is that increasingly we are, particularly in the West, increasingly ignorant of history. I think even as Christians, we know less and less about our historic formation as God's people. We know less about church history, less about even the history of the ideas that in the West have become profoundly important to us. So, for example, and which for the most part, actually, particularly the ones that we tend to cherish and treasure, have Christian roots. So, for example, like when I talk with my undergraduate students at university about, say, the idea of that we have fundamental kind of human rights, they love this idea, but so few of them actually know where the whole idea that a human being might be a rights-bearing individual even comes from. So we're kind of increasingly ignorant of history. There's all kinds of interesting empirical studies actually that back that up, that show, like in the US, for example, that we know less, current generations, up and coming generations know less and less about their history than previous ones. So there's, that kind of ignorance is reaching a new level. And then finally, a kind of a sense too, especially in the last 10 years with the advent of social media kind of polarizing our public discussions, our public conversations, that we tend to be kind of ahistorical in the sense that we are no longer able to engage in meaningful debate about the complexities of history without kind of turning it into a kind of culture wars, basically, where we either are forced to kind of think of history purely in black and white terms, or we're forced into categories where we either condemn or celebrate the past, where we find it very difficult to realize that historical figures and episodes of the past very rarely fit neatly into our own category. So we tend to reduce history to ideology, basically. And I think for those, if you think about those three characteristics, irrelevance and ignorance and ideology, then there's a way of kind of realizing the kind of cultural moment that we're living in, and therefore thinking about the importance of, okay, as a, as Christians, what are we called to do in terms of history? What does God tell us in the Bible about how he acts in history and how Christians are supposed to think about their history? What does that mean for us today, living in this ahistorical culture? How do we live as Christians? And then how do we think about telling the gospel to a non-Christian world, which I think is so ahistorical and yet deeply yearning for rootedness, yearning for a larger story?
Yeah, beautifully put. And to your point, I was just thinking about someone who I've quoted often. He is a prestigious philosopher. His name is Alex Rosenberg. And one of the things Alex Rosenberg says in a long litany of things which promote atheism, his book is, of course, Atheist Guide to Reality. He says, in query form, does history have any meaning or purpose? And then he answers that by saying, no, it's full of sound and fury, but signifies nothing. Does the human past have any lessons for the future? He says, fewer and fewer, if it ever had any to begin with. And I think that sort of summarizes where the culture is. And as you've alluded to, I mean, Christians are impacted by the culture. And this is the kind of thing, this is sort of the air that we're breathing today, an ahistorical perspective. And that's why I think that your book is so transcendently important. If we forget history, we lose the gossamer strand that connects us, that allows us to view our present in a meaningful fashion, recognizing that we are on a continuum. A continuum that reaches into the past, but even beyond the resurrection and the second coming of Jesus Christ, because history will continue in the new heavens and the new earth with a recreated universe. resurrected bodies will learn and grow, albeit without error, as forever we explore the glory and the grandeur of the one who created history with a purpose. Talk about how the disenchanted worldview leads us to be what I like to call wretched flatlanders. Nature has come to be understood in terms of how it works rather than what it means or what its purpose is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a profound reflection, actually. So, look, basically, it's probably really useful to think about this as a long-term kind of historical change. The really interesting thing is that in the early modern world, when the term Christendom actually is a historical and correct kind of word to think about the community of Christians, it was, and the philosopher Charles Taylor puts this really well, it was almost impossible not to believe in God in the year 1500, in the sense that the entire way that people approached their understanding of human life and the universe, the natural world, and so forth, was through the lens of God's ordering and purposes for the rest of creation. But gradually, what's happened over the last 500 years or so is a process that different historians and philosophers kind of refer to as a gradual kind of secularization, where increasingly, and this, again, I'm kind of simplifying here a whole lot of very complicated, you know, historical processes. But with the advent of modernity and what's called the Enlightenment Project, there's a kind of sense in which human beings think that they can, and they attempt to, understand themselves and the universe, the natural world, and so forth, without any reference to God. And so in the sort of late modern, and some, you know, for the last 30, 40 years or so, the term kind of postmodern has been bandied around, various kind of terms for understanding the characteristics of our culture and society after about the 1960s and 70s. In the late modern and kind of postmodern world, there is a kind of sense that we're in a kind of post-truth age in which there's no longer any kind of ultimate story. There's no kind of meta narrative, if you like, that gives us any kind of sense of purpose or any sense that time ultimately has any kind of ultimate meaning. And what that does is ultimately it leads people kind of desperately searching or inventing some kind of way of thinking about how they exist in time. Or it creates a kind of, I mean, and you see this in the kind of literature and some of the really kind of more pessimistic literature and philosophy in the late 20th century. Think about Albert Camus' work. Like, there's a kind of deep sense that human life perhaps is ultimately meaningless because time is ultimately meaningless. There's no purpose to the universe. But actually, as Christians, really, of course, the thing that we know as Christians is that there is an ultimate purpose to time, that time is given purpose and meaning by a God who actually shows us who he is through his mighty works in history. And just as somebody, I mean, you alluded to the fact before that, you know, I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I was very much a secular person who defined myself as an atheist in my 20s. And here I was doing a PhD at Cambridge. And in what actually kind of begins to strike me is that Christians actually have the framework for understanding why time and why history is meaningful in the first place. Right? Because in the rest, like in the ancient world, ancient philosophers basically think that the universe is eternal. But it's actually when Christianity arrives on the scene and when we have the Christians interpreting and revealing that actually the promised Messiah that is given to the Jews in the Old Testament is in fact Jesus Christ. And when you have Augustine writing The City of God, in which he gives us this kind of very clear articulation of the idea that no, history is, like, the history has meaning and purpose, that we have a framework for human beings understanding the kind of overarching kind of sweep of human history. And that's what gives life meaning and purpose. So it's little wonder, of course, that, you know, when you began by quoting Alex Rosenberg a few minutes ago, that there is this kind of sense of nihilism, of purposelessness, because, yeah, without a God who renders time meaningful, what kind of meaning or purpose to human life is there?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, I was thinking as you were speaking that the secular world also has a view of history that's linear in some sense. So today we talk a lot about the cult of progress, or the myth of progress, the idea that history is moving forward and we are evolving from human beings to human beings 2.0, that we're going to be transhuman. So we're becoming the gods of our own biology. We're becoming the gods of our own gender. We're now saying how things are going to transcend our normal limitations, and we're going to go into a golden age, what Donald Trump calls the golden age. I'm not criticizing any politician in saying this, but I'm simply saying there is a sense of progress in the secular worldview, too. It's a distorted sense. It's a sense without God, but it is a sense of progress. It's not as though the only thing that matters is today, because today we're moving on to becoming evolved human beings.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating observation, actually, because, well, not least because actually the whole idea of progress in the first place is actually a kind of, use the word distortion, I would even use the word perversion as well. Mm. There's a kind of secular perversion here of what actually enters the intellectual tradition of the West as a way of thinking about the advent of God's kingdom. Like it's actually only with the advent of Christianity and the hope and the not like the sure hope that we have that Christ will come again and remake the heavens and the earth, that we have any sense that history is going to ultimately end up anywhere. And the really interesting thing that's happened in the history of the West is that these ideas, and it particularly happens after the advent of the scientific revolution in the last few hundred years, ideas of progress increasingly get secularized. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that the ultimate goal, or what might say is the telos of that progress, which of course Christians know and historically was the idea of God's kingdom, Christ will return. But as they get secularized, so in other words, as they get unraveled from their Christian framework, what happens is that the ideas of like progress remain, but they remain as kind of as distortions and perversions because, and here's the thing, there's no longer any real sense of what that telos is, what the endpoint is. Is it some kind of, you mentioned earlier, you know, like transhumanism? Or is it a kind of, and I think that's why too, our culture at the moment almost oscillates wildly between the sense that there is a kind of progress which will end up in transhumanism and colonizing Mars, utopia and dystopia always so closely connected. And there's this idea that it will actually culminate in disaster, that there will be a kind of dystopian destruction of the planet. And one of the reasons why secular culture is struggling with this is because we've kind of inherited Christian ideas of progress and hope for a better world, which as Christians, we know it's the new heavens and the new earth. Like this is God's plan for history, but we unravel them from theology and think that the classic, you know, we'll worship the created things instead of the creator. We'll think that we can create our own kind of utopia. We lose that sense of telos or endpoint. And so we just maintain the sense that there is endless, boundless becoming and progress. And yet we're completely at a loss about where it actually ends up.
I found something fascinating in reading your book, and that is when you actually talk about when the ahistoric epoch began. And you would think, well, that happened maybe back with the Renaissance or the Enlightenment, but you say, no, it is very modern.
Yeah, so this is interesting. I think that there have been for some time, you know, there are long historical threads that give us the kind of origins of ahistoricism. I mean, even when C.S. Lewis was writing in the mid-20th century, he uses the phrase, chronological snobbery, right? There are moments in history in which there is a kind of sense. And this, yeah, I think this is characteristic of the kind of modern mindset too, right? That we are superior to the past. This is modernity. But I think there is something in the last 10 to 15 years, which is kind of uniquely, well, that there's a kind of unique moment really in the last 15 years. These things have kind of various threads, I think, have kind of coalesced to give us a new sense of in which the past is completely irrelevant. Not least, I think it's exacerbated by the fact that social media really finds its kind of origins in about 2012, 2013. And what that does is that it means that basically, A, the kind of conversations that we have in public are operating on a completely different level now. They're more and more polarized. We know how the algorithms work. So public discourse is transformed. And so, and also, of course, with the constant, you know, the 24-hour news cycle and the constant and rapid demand for new content means that we're kind of generating information and content without actually thinking that there is any need to kind of preserve and to continue. But of course, the other thing about social media too is that it exacerbates this radical kind of emancipatory individualism we have. That is to say, it really accentuates the way in which we think that life is really just about this constant process of self-invention. The more that we do this online, the more that we're constantly kind of creating content and inventing ourselves online, the less that we ever see ourselves, and I think even, this seeps into the church, the less that even the church, Christians collectively, see themselves as conserving and passing down a tradition and being part of a larger story.
Yeah, so I was just stunned when I read in your book 2010. It just seems so recent. And yet you say soon after 2010, five characteristics of ahistoricism intensified and coalesced. And I think you're very qualified in your writing. You didn't say it began, but it intensified and coalesced. And you argue then that the digital revolution and the rise of social media have acted like sparks to ignite the flame of ahistoricism in a number of different ways. And then you give illustrations of the ahistoric age. And one of the illustrations really caught my attention because, as I was saying earlier, I was just in Australia, and Australia is beautiful. I mean, you see these incredible churches. I was downtown in Melbourne, Australia, and I attended a number of churches there, but they're basically empty. And then you have these beautiful statues. But part of what you say in your book is that you have a mark or a telltale sign of ahistoricism with the toppling of statues.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a kind of a trend really that has begun. I mean, statues have been toppled in history, obviously. When the Soviet Union collapsed, when there's a kind of climactic crisis of the fall of governments in the late 1990s, Soviet Union collapsed, they pulled down the statues of Lenin and Stalin and Marx and so forth. But what's happening now is that there's a kind of a sense in which the toppling of and vandalism of statues is a kind of a constant display of how we think about history in everyday life. I mean, this happened again, we just celebrated our National Day, Australia Day, a month ago in January. And again, there's a kind of constant sense that, yeah, vandalizing statues is the political move that people make to symbolize where they stand in current politics. And that's an interesting thing when the approach to the past is just simply to kind of cancel, an attempt to kind of cancel a historical figure or to reveal them as nothing but somebody who supported racism or genocide or whatever it is. When historically, I mean, the interesting thing is too, like in Australian history, we've actually known for generations about various historical, like the ways in which Indigenous people were treated by the British for generations. And yet something happens in like the last 5 years in which now statues are being toppled. And this is not something that had actually really happened before. So there's a sense that that kind of mobilization and that kind of sense that there's no collective story that Australians will share about their past, which will enable them to have any kind of public or shared representation of the past without it being vandalized or attacked. There's no real kind of sense that we can do that anymore.
And when you're ahistorical, I love that word, ahistorical. When you're ahistorical, you don't have a sense of nuance. You look at the past as either black or white. You don't see things in their complexities.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one of the features of kind of the way in which we reduce history to ideology today. I mean, one, again, like a really interesting example of this from Australia is that one of our most important Indigenous leaders, Aboriginal leaders from the early 20th century, his name is William Cooper, and he's a Christian. And he's born in the 1860s on a Christian mission on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. And what he is, or his major kind of act of leadership is during the early 20th century, when Indigenous people didn't have the same civil and political rights as white Australians, Cooper, informed by not only the Western political tradition, but by his Christian faith, engages in an act which is entirely consistent with the way that, and Americans, I think, know this even better than Australians, consistent with the political tradition, which is the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, right? This is in the Magna Carta. And so here's Cooper putting himself in that tradition. So he creates a petition and he goes around and collects thousands of signatures or markings on the petition to petition, ultimately actually to petition the king, takes it to the federal government in Australia first in order to do this. And his whole argument actually is that the reason why Indigenous Australians ought to have the same political rights as non-Indigenous Australians is that they're all, not only are they all subjects of the British Empire, but they are all created equal. And he quotes the Bible and he says, we are of one blood. And he talks about God and he talks about being of one blood. And so again and again, this petition and the rest of his work, which is founded on his Christian belief that Indigenous Australians are created in God's image, their lives are inherently worthy and as valuable as any non-Indigenous Australian's life, framed by the Christian tradition. And yet the way that Cooper's kind of presented in, for example, the National Museum of Australia, is that the Christian part of this story is kind of written out, which is really interesting. So on the website of the museum and in the museum itself, there's like no, at least on the website, there is no mention, which I footnote in the book, so you can go and check it out. But there's no reference to his faith. There's no reference to the fact that the entire reason he could even make this argument in the first place is that he relies upon a biblical principle, which is that we are of one blood, as it were. And so there's an inability, I think, like you said earlier, to recognize that history is nuanced and complex. We're living in a cultural moment now in which, for some reason, there's a sense that if you're on the kind of progressive side of politics, then you must write out any reference to Christianity as playing a role in Indigenous rights in Australia. So they write out that part of history and they can't attend to the fact that, no, history is complex. Cooper doesn't fit into our category of what a kind of progressive Indigenous activist might look like today, because he is profoundly evangelical and Christian and wants the gospel to go out to Indigenous communities. So history is kind of nuanced. It's complex. It doesn't fit into our neat ideological categories.
You know, you mentioned museums, and I think that's another really important point to make on the podcast, because if you have children and you're taking them to museums, so often you need to be equipped to tell them what they're encountering, because so often what they encounter is not historical reality, but a political agenda.
Yeah, so this is the other interesting thing that I think was something that really illustrated the way that we're now living in the kind of ahistoric age is something uniquely happening in the last 10 to 15 years or so, because it was in, I think, 2019, I quote this in the book, so you have to check the footnotes and everything, but the international body that regulates museums redefined the purpose of what a museum is. It's the first time that this has happened in a very long time. So for centuries, really since the creation of the first kind of modern museum, the British Museum through Hans Sloane's collections, the idea is that a museum is a repository of the past, that it conserves and passes down the past. But the essence of the redefinition of what a museum was by this international body in the last 5 to 7 years completely so jettisons the idea that it's about conserving heritage and basically redefines it as having a role in the sort of the justice and the political, they use various phrases, perhaps social justice is in there. You can check, I've quoted it all in the book. But basically it redefines the purpose of the museum as an ideological and a political purpose to kind of remake the world, to reshape the world. And that's profoundly significant, right, in terms of what's happening here with how we think about history, because, and how we think about the public role of the stories that we tell, because for a very long time, this is about conserving and passing down a tradition. And yet suddenly in the last 10 to 15 years, there's this sense that, oh no, instead of conserving and passing down, we actually think about these things purely in terms of the purpose of reshaping the world, remaking the world. There's a reference actually, I think, to the ecology of the planet in the purpose of the museum now. There is a political role in the way that there wasn't historically.
Yeah, and it's just breathtaking when you say this is forged some 5 to 7 years ago. There's also something that I think you can speak about from personal experience as a professor of history. There's a steep decline in history majors all over the world.
That's right. some really interesting evidence, I quote, coming out of the American Historical Association in the last few years, like history majors plummeted, and they're plummeting faster than other humanities majors. History, I also give some kind of evidence from my own experience in Australia, is again, at my prior institution, my prior university, history majors basically kind of halved in the 10 years that I was there. So there's a kind of, there's a sense in which we're no longer thinking that history is really one of the basic kind of ways of equipping citizens for public life. I mean, this is the other really interesting thing too. I think this, and actually, I think this is true, particularly in America as much, perhaps even more so actually, given the sort of fascinating Republican tradition that we don't have in the same way in Australia. But both in America and Australia, there is a sense in which education is for the kind of public equipping of citizens for public life. And history has always played a very important role in that. So if you rewind back a few generations in either of our countries, there is a kind of sense that people who are educated, who went off to a liberal arts college or a university, the assumption is that you will be reading important books, you'll read the classics, and you'll also be educated in history, because the idea is that you have to know the stories that you are part of, as it were, the sort of the collective narrative about your own people, your nation, the ideas, the institute, like the institutions, where they came from, where did the common law come from, for example. You know about these institutions, and that knowledge of history is essential to being a citizen who participates in public life. But basically what's happened, probably more so actually in Australia than in America for various reasons, but now there's a kind of sense that we've almost kind of unraveled the idea that A, we educate to form the character of citizens, and B, that history should have a kind of role in that.
Yeah, you talk about five characteristics of a historic age, and the first of which, as I recall, has to do with a failure to recognize nuance, which we already talked about. But could you give us sort of an overview of those five characteristics? Maybe I should go through them with you, but the past is merely a source of shame and oppression from which we must free ourselves. And again, as I mentioned, we in this discussion already talked about the failure to recognize nuance. But it also involves a hyper-individualist and consumer mindset, as you point out in the book.
Yeah, that's right. So that first characteristic, that basically the only lens through which, particularly young people, like if you talk to students going through high school and college or university, basically the kind of lens that they approach history now is through this mindset of thinking that history is all about power, about oppressors and oppressed. And that effectively these kind of collective stories, it makes you inherent, well, first of all, it makes you inherently ashamed of any part of your own nation's history. Again, it's not to say there aren't complex parts of your nation's history and some things that are, you know, deeply, deeply problematic in Australia's history, for example. But seeing the past purely as a kind of story from which they have to free themselves from as a source of kind of domination and oppression is probably the first thing. And I think that's a real kind of intensification of this idea that we see the purpose in life really is to kind of free ourselves from all external authorities. Like if young people come out of their high schools and into college thinking that life is really about going on my own journey, right? A phrase we hear all the time, that educational institutions are all about empowering myself. That is it, like, when you probe a little bit, that's antithetical to any sense that we're part of a larger story and part of history. That's a kind of idea that, well, we need to free ourselves from all kind of external authority so that I can be my true self, so that I can go on my true journey. And so history is just a kind of a source of some kind of oppressional domination from which we have to free ourselves. That's why, coming back to the statue vandalism and toppling thing, why that's such a good illustration of that, because instead of being able to sit with any kind of complexity, there's a kind of sense that we'll know the statue, for example, of our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, or Lachlan Macquarie, one of our greatest governors in New South Wales, has to be knocked down, because there's no way that people have of thinking about the fact that the past is complex. It's not just a kind of source of oppression and domination. So that's probably the first thing.
You quote one of your students, an undergraduate student, saying, "Why should I study British Empire? Has absolutely nothing to do with my life." And there's some presuppositions underlying that kind of thought, but there's also a cultural milieu that sort of like I said before, it's like in the air. It sort of leads you to that kind of thinking, that ahistorical malaise.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a good illustration. It's something, I mean, it is one particular student, but really I've heard, you know, that.
You've heard
that
it
kind
a
of
thousand
paragraph.
times.
But yeah, because, so yeah, if we unpack that a little bit, right, what are the presuppositions? First of all, there's this kind of sense that, like, I would only study things that are relevant to my life because I think my life is about my relentless, like my ability to kind of create myself, invent myself. And so if I don't think that something is important to my life, like if I don't think I should read The Founders, or if I don't think I should read about the history of the British Empire or study that, then I shouldn't study it because my life is all about me. And then what happens to the idea of education there is that it's just a means to an end, and the end is self-empowerment. That's why, too, like, have you noticed too that interestingly, schools and universities increasingly use the language of empowerment to describe their purpose? Historically, that is not, like, you know, the earliest university in Bologna in the 11th century, the 1000s, the whole history of the university is not about self-empowerment, right? So there's a sense that today the student is going to reject studying history because basically they don't see it as relevant to their lives because they think their lives are all about self-invention.
You bring up a phrase in the book, and it is digital tribalism. Can you explain what digital tribalism entails?
Yeah. So I'm talking about this, I think, in the context of trying to show the church, to show other Christians that actually Christians are called to be part of, you know, God's historical people, a rich historical community. And the kind of community and fellowship that we have with each other and that we can learn so much more about, actually, if we read about how Christians have practiced fellowship historically, is so radically different to the kind of false, you know, communities, quote unquote, or digital tribalism that we see online. Because increasingly, you know, in the digital age, you know, there's that kind of classic paradox from which people are intensely atomized and isolated and lonely, and yet they find their community online. And so the kind of phenomenon that sociologists kind of refer to as digital kind of tribalism creates a kind of false community. And it's not a real community for various reasons, because there are no, it's a group of people who are just united merely by the fact that they share the same beliefs or preferences or interests or whatever. But there's no real community in the sense of, and of course, the model of community and fellowship is the church. And so, and the way that, you know, Christ has loved us and called us to be part of his body. So there's no, in digital tribes, there are no demands on each other's lives. You don't serve each other. You don't lay your life down for each other. You don't live in deep kind of fellowship and community with each other in terms of sharing meals together, serving each other at considerable cost or anything like that. And so that, yeah, I think that's really illustrative, because there's often a sense today that the internet has kind of brought us into a kind of new age in which there are different kinds of communities. But I think historically the church needs to, well, we need to be part of the kind of long historical communities that the church has always kind of done so well.
What does the ahistoric epoch of time look like with respect to the church? You just mentioned the church. I mean, what does that look like when the culture invades the church, or we become enculturated? We become part of the culture rather than transformers of the culture.
Yeah, this is really interesting, because I do think that there's always a tendency, of course, to kind of acculturate ourselves too much, or to acculturate ourselves in such a way that's actually kind of damaging. And, you know, I think this looks different in different parts of the church, but I do think that there are certain things today, certain kind of attitudes in the church towards the past that are really kind of problematic. And, you know, one of the biggest kind of idols and temptations that we face in, you know, very privileged countries like the USA and Australia and in the West in the church is the kind of comfortable kind of consumer lifestyle, highly individualistic lives in which we, you know, we're tempted to reduce faith to something that looks like the rest of culture, in the sense that, is it just like another is it just part of the wellness phenomenon? Is Christianity a kind of self-help doctrine? Which, of course, we know biblically it's not, but this is always a kind of temptation. And so one of the ways that ahistoricism can manifest itself in that respect is that it makes us kind of blind. Like, if we don't know the way that Christians have lived historically into their faith, then we are going to be like increasingly blind to the ways in which we are acculturating ourselves to things like individualism, the kind of sense that really the faith is just something, being a Christian is something that we might do on a Sunday morning, that really the church is kind of there to serve us, makes us blind to seeing like celebrity pastors. Again, not a phenomenon that existed in previous generations. But I think that's why if we actually understand something about history, we can kind of sharpen our understanding of culture, and we can be very wary of the way we can be more aware of the kind of temptations we have for current kind of cultural idols.
When you talk about celebrity pastors, you know, my father was a pastor, and his work was anything but that of a celebrity. I mean, he had to tend the flock. He had to marry and bury. He had to counsel people. I mean, it was hard work. And one of the things that your real contribution you make in the book is the disjuncture between the kind of pastor that's become all the more prominent in our culture and pastors that really did the hard work of ministry, tending the flock, caring for the flock, teaching the word of God. I mean, I think of, you know, I'm going to name a name. Andy Stanley is a great example of a celebrity pastor. He's got one of the largest church networks in the world. He's in the United States. He actually, you talk about ahistoricism, he says that the Old Testament has nothing worthwhile to say to us today. You ought to call it the obsolete testament. We should not read the Old Testament, because if you read the Old Testament, you're going to have a sense of an entitlement to slavery, and you're going to have a false sense of God. You're going to be worshiping a false God and all of that. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. These people are more managers of large Christian cults than they are people that are teaching their constituents how the Old Testament and the New Testament are inextricably woven together in a beautiful harmonic tapestry.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the way that you were, again, speaking about the actual kind of day-to-day pastoring work of caring for the flock that your father did. I know I was really instructed when I read Eugene Peterson's work. I mean, the interesting thing about this is that they are historic ways in which pastors have tended to the flock. But if we actually don't know that historically that's what ministry looked like, that's what pastoring involved, I think we're much more likely to just kind of jettison the past because we're ignorant of it, we don't know about it, and to kind of think that really the role of the pastor is merely as a kind of CEO or a manager who just delegates. But historically, and even biblically, of course, that's not what actually pastoring looked like. And I think there are other examples too. In some churches, so this is more about, so for example, if you take the worship service, I think another way that the ahistoric age can kind of creep into the church is that we tend to kind of assume sometimes that historical practices are just not relevant anymore, or if we don't know about them. And suddenly what you end up with is a service that actually is not only out of step with how we have met together and shared fellowship as Christians, but is also kind of unbiblical too. So, for example, there's a kind of sense that any kind of tradition of coming into church and praying a prayer of confession of sin, which historically has been, we're told to confess our sins. Historically, Christians, when they meet together, they confess their sins. But there is a tendency to kind of make worship service about entertainment, and then you abandon these kind of practices. The practice of sharing the peace too often can be kind of abandoned. And yet we're told, you know, share the peace. And another one that I think is pretty interesting is the kind of reverence in which historically we've celebrated the Lord's Supper. Well, if you have kind of pop music on in the background and the Lord's Supper is so denuded of its reverence and significance, and the fact that we worship a transcendent God, then you turn the Lord's Supper into entertainment. Likewise, I've been in church services that conclude with, instead of ascending, which is historically God's people, after they meet together, they are sent back out. And this looks different in different denominational traditions, but there's a sending back out into the world, which encapsulates the fact that you've been brought together as God's people, You've met and worshiped God and heard his word preached and sung praises to him and so forth. You are being sent back out into the world to serve him. But a really good illustration of ahistoricism, I think, is when a church service just ends with the service leader saying, okay, have a great week, which is really common. But the thing is, we often don't realize that. I think actually should really be shocking and jarring to us. But I think one of the reasons why sometimes we don't see that as shocking and jarring is because we're so acculturated to the ahistoric age, we're so ignorant of how Christians have met together historically, that we don't even see the idols of our culture. Because unpack what's happening there when the service leader says, have a great week. Well, the idol is your week and your time is about you. You're not being sent back out into the world to serve God. You're enjoying your week because your week is about you. But historically, that's not how Christians have thought about what worship is all about. But the more that we forget what we have been doing historically, the more that we just kind of acculturate ourselves to this.
Yeah, and the church has a rhythm. There are seasons of the church, and we order our lives as Christians around the rhythm of the church. It invades every aspect of our life, so it's not going to church. It becomes a way of life.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things I talk about in the book, so after I kind of do this cultural analysis of the ahistoric age, I want to really show Christians that actually there is a path forward here. I think that if we tend and keep and steward the past, one of the things Christians can do is use the past as this kind of vast treasury. That beautiful phrase, by the way, a phrase that Isaac Watts, the wonderful hymn writer, uses, a vast treasury to help us. And I think one of the ways that it does that is that we can draw upon things like the lectionary, or the, for example, or liturgy, or the church calendar to kind of order our time. My family did this we began doing this a couple of years ago when we decided to kind of really lean into the church calendar and what in the Anglican tradition is called the daily office. And we sort of step by step, gradually, we're reorienting our time and redeeming our time, I think, around these kind of historic practices that enabled us to kind of structure our time around the story that God gives us and the kind of the rhythms of life that structure the church. And these are kind of daily rhythms, like we meet for prayer in the morning, like we pray morning prayer in my family. But again, historically, there's morning prayer in different Protestant denominations and in all kinds of, in the Eastern Church and the Catholic Church, there are kind of historically, actually, Christians have structured their days around cycles of prayer and devotion. And this can be really helpful for us because, of course, we're living in a culture in which our culture is more than happy to structure our time for us. There are secular seasons, our work or the demands of consumerism, or just, you know, the way that we kind of secularize events, like we turn Christmas into the holiday season. We're actually living in a culture which is going to structure our time for us if we let it.
That is a brilliant point. I mean, it's not just that we are no longer structuring our time around God's purposes and God's plan, but the secular world has an alternative for us. And so often we embrace that alternative without even knowing that we're doing it.
Yeah, that's so true. I think one of the things that I hear, so when I talk about my book in the Australian evangelical context, one of the kind of, particularly from like older generations, one of the kind of pushbacks I get most often is this kind of anxiety about, oh gosh, you know, tradition or church calendar, that makes it seem like we're not actually evangelical anymore, or we don't actually believe the gospel anymore, because there's this kind of sense that tradition equals no longer an authentic faith or something. And I think while there are sort of moments in which, yeah, of course, tradition can be empty, but the other thing that's going on there is that I think there is also a profound blindness to the idols of our own culture, because so often what happens is that underneath all that, so underneath the idea that we could even engage in any kind of tradition of liturgical prayer, like praying from the Book of Common Prayer, is this kind of anxiety that to do that would mean we're not authentically expressing ourselves to God. And yet at the same time, the idea that prayer is just about my authentic self-expression to God, you know, that's the idol of like, of individualism, of authentic self-expression. Like there is a time and a place for that. But the idea that that is the primary function of prayer, that is imbibing a kind of idol of a highly individualistic culture, but we so often don't realize that. So I think, again, that's what history can do. It can actually sharpen us to enable us to understand the idols of our own culture.
I was so excited as reading through your book. You quote one of my favorite quotes, I've quoted it often, but Yaroslav Pelikan, where he says, tradition is the living faith of the dead, but traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And I think that is absolutely a delicious quote because it puts tradition in the right light by contrasting it. I always say contrast is the conduit to clarity, contrasting tradition with traditionalism, the problem being the ism.
Yeah, that's right. And it may be surprising in our culture, and it is actually countercultural in a very kind of hyper-individualistic age, to think that actually, you know, tradition can actually be helpful for us. And the kind of the stories that we pass down and the ways that Christians actually through the centuries have lived their faith can be helpful for us. That's countercultural, but actually I think it's biblical and it can be enormously helpful to us. The way that Christians have lived for centuries has actually been to think of themselves and to understand that what they're doing is consciously part of a larger story. I mean, I think one of the best examples, probably pretty pertinent to the fact that we're recording this actually just before Lent begins, but is actually Lent as a kind of a tradition. Again, Lent, the kind of spiritual disciplines and practices that Christians undergo in Lent, there's not a sense, if you are a Christian, that these things are going to save you. But there is a sense that when you are part of a historic people who live their lives in a way in which God's saving history and the story that they're adopted into, right, when they're grafted into the faith, made a son of Abraham through faith, that actually kind of structures their lives. And so each year on Ash Wednesday, my family and I will go and we will go to an Ash Wednesday service, and there'll be ashes. This is a very countercultural thing in evangelical, like we are evangelicals, and this is not what most evangelicals are doing, at least in Australia. So it's something difficult to get your heads around, I think. But no, actually, to receive the ashes on the forehead, to live in such a way in which you're consciously living as part of God's people, and then to go through Lent, preparing your heart, whether it's through, and again, it's not legalistic, perhaps it's fasting for some people, perhaps there are Lenten disciplines, almsgiving. You're actually living as part of the story of God's historic people that's been handed down to you. And I think it's really, you know, when Paul says in his first letter to Corinthians, these things, like, the, you know, the stories of the Old Testament, these things have been written down for our instruction. I think there is the sense in which Christians are called to not only remember these stories and pass them down, but then also kind of live into sacred history. And we do this by ordering our time.
Yeah, beautifully said. I think one of the most important parts of your book is where you observe the outworkings of the ahistoric attitude that's pervaded the church. And the first of that is doctrinal drift from orthodoxy, from the faith once for all delivered to the saints, from what was believed everywhere, always, and by all. So you have this doctrinal drift. And one of the key points you make is the doctrinal drift is seen in same-sex sexuality, redefining marriage. I mean, if you think at the beginning of human civilization, you have church and you have government and you also have marriage. Marriage is foundational to all of human civilization. It's not just a thing, it's the thing.
Yeah, that's right. I think the interesting thing there about ahistoricism is that doctrinal drift was one of the kind of characteristics, I think, of the ahistoric age in the church, in the sense that I think it's very revealing that no, and Tim Keller's kind of made this point as well, and I'm echoing him here, but no Christian denomination throughout history in the Eastern or the Western church, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, has ever redefined marriage like this. And so when we're in a historical, we're in a cultural moment in which we just kind of redefine doctrine in such a way that's completely out of step with 2,000 years of Christian theology, then it's quite revealing, I think, of the extent to which we just kind of think that the past and the way that we've thought about things in the past is irrelevant.
Yeah, so that's one of the characteristics. Another characteristic that you point out is individualism and comfort, an emphasis that shifts the point of reference from a costly discipleship to a therapeutic individualism. Expand on that.
Yeah. Well, this is
cheap
the idea
grace
that,
is another way of talking about it.
Yeah, the beautiful Bonhoeffer quote. I mean, look, historians and sociologists, I mean, Christian Smith did a great job of, and even coining the term moral therapeutic deism, have noticed for some time that one of the kind of characteristics of a Christianity which is so acculturated to a very kind of post-industrial and hyper-individualistic age is the sense that basically it is, well, it acculturates to consumerism in many ways, in the sense that the faith really becomes a kind of pathway to my self-help. It becomes a kind of lifestyle. It becomes about therapy and about sort of self-empowerment. And in that sense, it is no longer a walk with Jesus, right? And there are ways in which we see this. Yeah, obviously this looks, we can see this in all kinds of ways kind of creeping into the church, that emphasis on the kind of therapy, that Christianity is nothing but a kind of therapy to help me live my best life. But it's profoundly unbiblical, right? Like those who seek to save their life will lose it. Like we have to be willing to die to ourselves and be willing to suffer for Christ. In fact, it is granted just in our small group last night in Philippians, but you know, really mulling over the fact that, you know, it is granted to you to suffer. Like how difficult and countercultural that is for us today, like living in the West, missionaries and our persecuted brothers and sisters in the rest of the world actually understand this much better than us, but that it is granted to us to suffer. Yeah,
beautiful. You know, I want to skip over to what you say when you talk about a consumerist and marketing model as one of the indications of drift within the historic Christian faith. And you say, here's a quintessential example, and I'm quoting you, evangelicals in Australia frequently discuss whether they should celebrate the Lord's Supper on Easter Sunday because it seems too weird, awkward, or uncomfortable to outsiders. That is a stunning statement in and of itself. When you think about the sacramental liturgical history of the church at the very epicenter of everything, the epicenter of liturgy. In fact, liturgy is the Lord's Supper. It is partaking of the real presence of Christ. It is that receiving of zoetic energy by which you can live not by might nor by power, but by His Spirit. It's not just about biological energy. It's about spiritual energy that you receive when you partake of the real presence of Christ. It's transformative. It's transforming you from one glory to another so that you, in fact, have the wherewithal, the power, the energy, you know, you're energized by all His energy, as St. Paul says, which so powerfully energizes me, the energy by which to transform the world. And here now we want to denude the church of the Lord's Supper because it might seem weird or awkward. And it seems also, and I want to say this, it seems very counterintuitive in a lot of ways because right now I'm in a church. We don't have enough space for the people. The people are flooding in, but it's a sacramental liturgical church. It happens to be an Orthodox church. People want to come in because they are intoxicated in a world denuded of intoxication. They're intoxicated by the mystery of God, by the sacredness, by beauty, by all of these things. It's captivating them. So there's a sense in which the churches that are recognizing that the Lord's Supper is not just a remembrance, but has efficacious meaning in our life, attracts people today.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting, like, I mean, I gave an Australian example there, and I can comment from that kind of Australian perspective too, that it's interesting that one of the reasons why the Lord's Supper was often, in our context, not celebrated on Easter Sunday was that there was a moment for a while, and it probably served its purpose at a different historical moment, where at least the kind of thought was that we need to make Christianity kind of relevant to the culture. And I don't for a moment think that that means you should not celebrate the Lord's Supper. But I think that when you unpack it, that's the kind of thought behind it. There's this kind of constant sense that we need to make the church relevant to the culture. We need to make the church like the culture. But this is a very different moment culturally now. And I think regardless, the deeper thing going on here too, which is what you were alluding to when you talked about the number of people in your church yearning for a sense that God is actually transcendent and sacred, is that there is a kind of a secularizing, tendency, particularly, well, in some parts of the evangelical church that I'm broadly speaking a part of more than others, in which we so denude the world of the transcendence of God and of any sense of the sacred, because there's this kind of knee-jerk reaction that to think that God might be sacred, or the moment we think about wonder, we might, that maybe that's Catholic. There's a kind of anxiety that that might mean that we were pre-Reformation or something. But I think there's a kind of deep problem that some branches of evangelicals have with trying to grapple with actually engaging with a transcendent and holy God. And it's interesting too that theologically, like in Australia, this kind of sense that nothing happens at the Lord's Supper isn't even in keeping with, so that's a Zwinglian kind of theology. It's just memorialism, if that. And yet, even
See, I
with
can tell
like,
you're a professor of history because many people wouldn't know what you just said.
okay, so we should
That
explain
is
that for a moment.
absolutely true.
Yeah, okay, so sorry, what I'm saying there for a moment is what I was noticing happening is that even in evangelical churches that are in the Anglican tradition in Australia, like part of the Anglican tradition, there's actually a departure even from Anglican theology about the Lord's Supper. And that's a very clear statement you can make, because in the 39 articles, which are the written guide canon, if you like, for Anglican, not in the biblical sense of canon, but canon in terms of authority for what Anglicans believe, the 39 articles, there is a very careful insistence that they don't believe that the Lord's Supper is just remembrance, that it is completely devoid of any kind of spiritual presence. I mean, even Calvin, who many evangelical Anglicans love, even Calvin is not saying that nothing spiritually happens in the Lord's Supper. And yet, it seems to me that the practice, like functional reality of what happens in many Anglican churches, at least in Australia, is that they just think that the Lord's Supper is nothing but memorialism, which imports a kind of, so, and what I mean by memorialism is the idea that, well, we're just kind of doing this as a symbol, nothing spiritual happens. So when I referred to Zwingli, a Reformation kind of thinker, that's a kind of broadly Zwinglian approach. But my point is, that's not even in keeping with historically, or even what Anglicans believe at the present. So it's really interesting that what's even happening here is that there is such a kind of secularization, like in evangelical churches, that we have so taken out even a kind of sense that anything spiritual happens in the Lord's Supper. And that is not even what Anglicans have believed historically. It's not even what most evangelicals believed historically. It's not even what Calvin believed historically. So isn't it fascinating that we have now basically acculturated ourselves to a kind of almost a materialistic sense that, well, where is God's presence then? Where is what actually happens? It's not even in keeping with our own tradition.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about Zwingli. I was immediately thinking about a historical event, and I'll sort of characterize it for you off the top of my head. But I think it was 1529, there was a debate between Zwingli and Luther at the Marburg Castle in Germany. And the debate was about a lot of things. But during the debate, I don't want to mischaracterize it, during the debate, and this is my paraphrase, it was a colloquy. But Zwingli was actually accusing Luther of bread worship because Luther still believed in the real presence of Christ, not just the spiritual presence of Christ or not just a memorial, but the real presence of Christ. And so Zwingli said to Luther, he said, "How can Christ really be present in the Eucharist?" And Luther responded to the effect of saying, "Look, if you can explain to me how Christ can be one person with two natures, I'll explain to you how Christ can be present in the Eucharist." In other words, it's a mystery. And I think this is part of what you're driving at in the book. There's a mystery that we are now denuding the church of. You know, what the Latin phrase, the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the mystery that causes us to tremble and yet attracts us. And I think today's generation, having gone through this ahistoricism, is looking for mystery. is looking for the very thing that we're trying to rob the church of.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's why there is a kind of a flurry now of interest in things, in, I think, really dangerous idols, right? But that tap into awe and transit. So yeah, flurry of interest in like paganism and witchcraft and, I mean, yeah, false ways of trying to access the divine, where actually, of course, Christians know they have the revelation of God. And actually, for me as a historian, what the book's trying to say is actually, if you look into Christian history, we have a whole wealth of tradition. And this kind of takes me to the chapter on like art and beauty and sacredness in the book, because there's this whole rich tradition in which Christians have praised God's beauty and transcendence through, for example, I mean, sacred music. I often say, you know, when I'm speaking at events or, you know, speaking to my students, gosh, if you haven't like listened to some Gregorian chants, listen to the whole early music, like sacred music tradition, this is music. Or even like, listen, I talk about J.S. Bach in the book, and the fact that, you know, we have Bach's Bible and he annotates his Bible and he talks about the way that his music is for the glory, soli Deo Gloria, like for the glory of God alone. There is a whole tradition of using art and beauty. I mean, the poetry of George Herbert is another example I talk about and quote in the book. There are ways, I mean, God created human beings with the ability to create, with the ability to appreciate beauty, which comes from him, and therefore like the ability to create in such a way that we can actually praise something of God's transcendence through the music and the poetry and the art that we create. And we've been doing that historically. So let's, in the current cultural moment that we're in, let's actually turn back to that and see how that can actually help us today to revive and strengthen our faith and our ability to appreciate that God is the author of beauty and the transcendence for which we long.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that you might want to emphasize for our listeners is the fact that church is an embodied experience, that you can't really do church via Zoom. It requires human beings to interact in a physical sense.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting that C.S. Lewis talked about the way that what we do with our body matters. And I think historically, one of the things that we've often kind of thrown away in the last, well, in the ahistoric age, perhaps even a little bit before that too, is a kind of sense that the historic ways in which we've embodied the faith in worship and other ways and in other times have been something that we no longer do anymore. But actually, like kneeling in prayer, for example, is something that can be incredibly helpful. Like to go and actually kneel for the Lord's Supper and to put your hands out and to receive the Lord's Supper, to put yourself in a posture in which you are embodying the fact that you are an unworthy sinner, like to bow your head in prayer, the things that we do with our body actually count. But I think, again, we're so living in an age in which we separate the mind or the spiritual from the body. And we think that bodies, we have various funny ways, I think, of thinking about the body and what we should do about it, that we often kind of reject the sense that actually that church is an embodied experience. But it actually is, and it always has been, and that can be extremely helpful for us. And there's nothing like kneeling in prayer for a while to realize how fragile your body is and how dependent you are on God. I mean, again, like the tradition of fasting, for various reasons, read the church father, like church fathers writing about fasting, there are Christians and theologians for centuries writing about fasting, but like the depriving of the body of food and the kind of sense that this is a way of trying to embody your own dependence on and like need for the gospel, and yet you're desperate kind of the ways in which you so dearly crave that food. These things can be enormously helpful.
Yeah. And one thing you talk about in that same context is night vigils. I mean, for a lot of people talking about night vigils, they have no clue what we're talking about whatsoever. And quite frankly, for most of my Christian life, I didn't either. And I actually came upon night vigils by osmosis, or maybe not by osmosis, but I mean, I have a hard time sleeping. So I used to, you know, just struggle laying in bed. And now what I do, if I can't sleep, I just get up and I pray. And I don't pray extemporaneously. I mean, I use a prayer book, actually. One of the prayers I use is a small compline. But I use prayers that have historical value. And I used that time wisely. And for me, that was sort of an entrance into this idea of night vigil. I wouldn't say that I'm an expert on it by any stretch of the imagination, nor have I made this a consistent aspect of my life. But I do think that your pointing to night vigils has real import in an age of ahistoricism.
Yeah, thank you. Gosh, it's fascinating that has been really helpful to you. And it's just, you know, when you're doing that, it's really interesting too that you use a form of Compline. Again, when you're praying Compline at night, what a beautiful way of living into the story of being part of God's people, that you're praying prayers and in the same way and with the same kind of form that generations, well, first of all, across the world, my family and I often pray Compline as well. There are Christians across the world, geographically, horizontally, but for generations and for millennia have been praying, because actually the whole tradition of staying up during the night and keeping watch and praying is developed, well, of course, with biblical precedent, right? Like Paul and Silas, there they are singing hymns during the night. Paul's singing when he's in prison. Christ, of course, in the Garden of Gethsemane, like they are awake and praying during the night. And of course, you know, the psalmist talking about meditating on God during the night. And then this tradition of praying, particularly the Psalms, actually, and when early Christians and the monastic movement begins to take off in the early centuries, actually what they're doing is that they are remaining up during the night and they are singing the Psalms antiphonally. So in the book, one of the things I'm trying to do is to show Christians that there are spiritual disciplines that we've practiced in the past in different parts of the church that can be enormously helpful today. And back in the 17th century in England, there's a little Anglican community in a village called Little Gidding. And I talk about some of their spiritual practices, one of which, like you mentioned, is this night vigil. And what they're doing is they often stay up in pairs. Of course, it's 17th century. This is by candlelight. And they're singing the Psalms antiphonally. So again, that's an old tradition too, call and response. Like it will be either be a half verse or a verse, and then somebody will sing the other part of the verse. And that is a way of praising God and of using their time to praise God. And it's such a helpful kind of practice. But another one, and this one often actually is so surprising to Christians to learn, because even in the 17th century, the phrase Protestant meditation is used, and there's a whole history that actually goes back far longer than the 17th century of Christian meditation, which again, it's probably a good illustration of our ahistoricism that today, if we hear the term meditation, we tend to think, oh, that's something invented by Eastern spirituality. That's not even Christian. But actually, meditation is at its origins, like in our tradition, a Christian practice of meditating on God's word. And there are all kinds of instruction pamphlets and books printed. And I talk about one in the 17th century in which it's basically a kind of instruction book about, it's called Protestant Meditation, published in the 1600s. And again, it's another spiritual practice which so many Christians today who don't know much about the history and the rich history of the church and how they're part of a historical people, and who just kind of think, oh, well, my faith means just a kind of individualistic sense that I'm united with these people by the fact we agree on the same doctrines. It's like, well, yeah, that's part of it, but you're part of a historical people. And actually, if we learn something about the ways in which they practice their faith, that can be so incredibly helpful for us today.
I want you to unpack the meaning of a word that you use in your book, presentism. We've sort of touched on that, but I was thinking when I was formulating this question for you, I was thinking about another quote by Yaroslav Pelikan where he said, tradition lives in living conversation with the past.
Yeah, there's a sense too that throughout, one of the wonderful things actually about the Christian tradition is that there is an ongoing conversation, not just with the Bible, but actually with Christian authors and theologians. And that is actually how the tradition and how the intellectual riches of Christianity, and actually more broadly speaking, how the intellectual traditions of Western and the Eastern Church have developed, because there's this sense that we're in conversation with the past. Again, C.S. Lewis put it so well that actually, if we join at 11 p.m. a conversation which began at 8, we're missing really the heart of, I'm paraphrasing him here, but missing the heart of really what's going on. And here's a really interesting illustration of this. Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, probably his most famous work, is Systematic Theology, right? Calvin's writing this in the midst of the Reformation in the 1520s, 1530s. And here's the interesting thing. Many today in Bible college or just elsewhere in the evangelical church will kind of assume that Calvin, of course, his well-known reformer for emphasizing the importance and the authority of the Bible, absolutely. But if you actually look at the Institutes, Calvin is in constant conversation, of course, not only with the Bible, but actually with the rest of the like Christian and non-Christian tradition, because he's trying to articulate what he believes and how Christians ought to systematically think about all these doctrines and principles in terms of this long conversation. So they're actually in there's 60 odd other authors outside of the Bible that Calvin lists in the Institutes. And so you can read the Institutes and you realize that actually the reformers themselves are part of a long conversation. He's quoting Lactantius and he's quoting Aristotle and he's quoting Plato. Like, Christians are always part of a long conversation, and that can be really helpful for us too if we think about that today, because there's a long conversation about really all the kind of ideas that we're interested in today. I mean, I was struck, for example, during COVID, obviously there's a lot of debate about this kind of issue of, well, to what are the extent and limits of secular authority, so the government's authority over our life, and to what extent can you resist an unjust law, all these kind of things. And the really interesting thing is that actually, these ideas have been talked about historically for hundreds of years. There's a whole tradition here. We're part of a long conversation. Like Luther famously in 1523 writes on secular authority, in which he's dealing with these kind of issues. Like, people have been thinking about all of these issues for so long. And if we realize we're part of that conversation, again, it can be incredibly helpful because we can draw upon those insights and those riches.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I want to really drive home in this podcast is the fact that we have to know our history so we can understand that we're part of that history, that Christ invaded time and space, that he came into history, that he's a man of history. He's the God-man, but he is a man of history. He shaped history by becoming part of history in the incarnation. And then as part of that, how the Bible instructs God's people to pass down their history and learn from it. I mean, the quintessential example is Moses, but you have so many great authors throughout the centuries that have hammered home this point. This is a quote I used to have in my head, but I'll read it. Jacob Neusner. He's one of the most published authors in history. And I love this quote. He says, "Civilization hangs suspended from generation to generation by something I mentioned earlier, by the gossamer strand of memory. If only one cohort of mothers and fathers fails to convey to its children what it has learned from its parents, then the great chain of learning and wisdom snaps. If the guardians of human knowledge stumble only one time in their fall, collapses the whole edifice of knowledge and understanding." And Moses said much the same thing. He exhorted the people of the promise to impress the words of the Almighty upon the hearts of their children and their children's children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. And above all, he says, do not forget. And you would add to that what he's implying, do not forget your history.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, yeah, like Paul said, you know, these things are written down for our instruction. And it's, I think, the major kind of temptation today that we often don't even realize is so powerful is to think of faith and think of being a Christian in a contemporary culture as just a kind of set of doctrinal positions that I happen to agree upon, but I basically kind of live my life. I'm united with the rest of the church kind of geographically, but really there's no sense that I'm actually part of a historical people. But actually, biblically, we are part of a people that God has saved through his historical acts and through the life, death, and resurrection of God himself, who has come to inhabit time And in doing so, like render time meaningful. And we're part of, Christians are part of that story. We are part of a people who God saves in time. And that's the most incredible thing when you think about the fact that for somebody, well, for many people who are like Gentiles and not part of the Jews, like this invitation has gone out to the whole world. And when you become a Christian, you are actually grafted into a historical people. You are saved into a people, saved into a family. And so you're actually saved into that history. And so that history becomes your history, right? Like the great cloud of witnesses becomes like they're your spiritual ancestors. I mean, often when my husband and I kind of talk to our kids about the stories that they're part of in the church, we kind of make the point that people, so the kind of like heroes of church history. So I was, thinking recently, for example, about Gladys Aylward, a missionary in China in the 1930s. There are all kinds of, I mean, Christians historically whose, whose stories we read and we pass down. It's actually really helpful to remember and to live in such a way that you realize, oh no, these are like, this is your story. I'm not genetically related to so many of these Christians in this great cloud of witnesses, but actually, through the blood of Christ, I am like, these are my spiritual ancestors, and I'm part of this story. And so those stories that we are called to kind of pass down, they become your history. And I think that's such a powerful and a beautiful way of presenting the gospel in an age in which so many people are rootless and disconnected and lonely, whose personal histories, either they don't know their family history, like life and time are perhaps, yeah, deeply fraught. And it's what Christians can actually do is to say, not only are you kind of, you are loved and forgiven by the Lord, when you become a Christian, you are also, of course, part of his people, and you are given an identity and inheritance, which is actually historical. It's an incredible thing. I mean, even just as a historian, thinking about the fact that the claims of Christianity at heart rest upon, from a historical point of view, like the actual historical claims of, did Jesus live and die, and was he raised from the dead? What happened with the empty tomb? That is profoundly unique. And I would really encourage anyone who has doubts about Christianity to kind of read about the historical evidence for the historical man of Jesus Christ and the empty tomb, because the claims of Christianity cannot be kind of watered down or thought as if they're kind of analogous to any other religion. They rest upon a historical claim.
Yep, and certainly the historical claim of the resurrection, which St. Paul calls of first importance. And if Christ has not been risen from the dead, eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you die. So Paul is making the point that Christ is not only a man of history, but he demonstrated that he was God through the immutable fact of resurrection. There's a word that you've been using over and over again throughout this discussion, and you just used the word about three or four times in the last few comments you made, and that is the word read, and that is music to my ears. I wrote a whole section on the importance of reading in one of my books. And you emphasize this so well in your book, how significant it is to read. John Wesley once said that if you don't read as a pastor, you're just a trifler. C.S. Lewis made the point that if you read a book only once, you've never really read that book at all. You need to read books over and over, digest them, And there are so many great books to read. I often talk about, a book people get started with, like Mere Christianity. It's a book that you can read over and over again, and you get a real sense of history doing so. So anyway, I'm not trying to take your place in elaboration on this, because you do such a beautiful job of elaborating on the importance of reading. And I think that's a lost art in the digital age.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, increasingly, there are concerns that we're kind of losing our literacy. AI has all kinds of terrible, I think, implications for our ability to kind of think and to write and our willingness to read. If we can just, like, why would we? Well, there are many reasons for this, but kind of one way of thinking, unfortunately, at the moment is, why would I go and do all the research and kind of read all of these books when I could ask ChatGPT a question? But there is something that happens to us when we read with the renewal of our mind, with using our minds as God intended us to. And there is just such a wealth of books to be read. No matter how old you get, you're never going to read all the books that need to be read. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you tell the story of studying for your doctorate at Cambridge, how you were an atheist at the time, how you immersed yourself at that particular junction in your life with the study of the 17th century chemist Robert Boyle. That had a great impact on your life, and it's part of your testimony.
Yeah, it did. I basically arrived at Cambridge as somebody who was a complete kind of non-believer. And one of the first things that happened to me was having to encounter the fact that the 17th century natural philosophers, so that's a kind of term that was used at the time, these are people like you mentioned, like Robert Boyle, John Locke in many ways, a natural philosopher and a political theorist, like the people I was studying for my PhD were deep believers in the Christian faith. And that begins to kind of unsettle some of the kind of very sort of caricature-like and arrogant assumptions I'd had about Christianity. And the thing that is probably so profound and beautiful about Boyle, and was really kind of striking to me, is that I'm reading Boyle because I'm writing a PhD at the time on what we now call science and the origins of British Empire. So I'm interested in Boyle's like scientific work and the fact that he's involved in colonization. And yet throughout all of what we would now call his kind of scientific work, Boyle is quoting the Bible. Like he's quoting Psalm 8. He is quoting an idea that comes up again and again, is this idea actually of Genesis 1:26 to 28, this idea of being created in God's image and then having dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and all the living things that creep upon the earth, and what that kind of dominion or responsibility looks like. And so this is kind of striking to me that, you know, here I am trying to write a PhD about the origins of science, but I can't actually do it without trying to understand why on earth these early modern natural philosophers who are founders of modern science are talking about their Christian faith all the time. So, that, I mean, that doesn't make me a Christian right then and there or anything, but it really begins to unsettle assumptions that I have. And it persuades me of the fact that, oh no, this, you can be a serious believer here and a great intellect, and there's something kind of going on here. I could talk a little bit more about my faith story if you like.
You know, I was going to ask you to do that anyway, and I would love you to do this. Is a perfect time for you to share your testimony. It's really powerful because you come out of a secular culture, a secular lifestyle.
Yeah.
And you become a Christian, and reading is part of your journey, reading and studying. And there's a beauty to it, there's an elegance to it. It's transformational to every aspect of our lives. But your testimony, I love that part of the book. And I also, something I'd like you to comment about as well, I'll prompt you if you forget, but it's not only your testimony that is riveting in this book, but you tell the testimony of so many significant people, people that were involved in the abolitionist movement and so forth. So testimony is a powerful way of conveying truth, and I found your testimony intoxicatingly beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Okay, well, I started with that kind of episode about what happened when I got to Cambridge. I mean, probably just the precursor to that is that I grew up in Australia, which is a very kind of, secular country. I grew up in a really loving home that encouraged me to grapple with ideas, but very much like a non-Christian home. And so by the time I was in my late teens and early 20s, I really kind of thought of myself as a non-believer or as an atheist. And so then we have that kind of, the first kind of thing I think significant that happens is, in terms of my faith, is that when I am at the University of Cambridge doing my PhD, I'm encountering these early modern philosophers who are deeply, deeply Christian. And I'm kind of needing to kind of make sense of that. And then after I finished my PhD, I was elected to a junior research fellowship in history at the University of Oxford. And that's a really significant kind of time for me because at one point, my friends and I go to hear a series of lectures that are given by one of the really well-known atheist philosophers, the ethicist Peter Singer. And he's really one of the world's kind of leading ethicists. Yeah, some of the listeners will have heard of Singer or perhaps be familiar with his work. I know you are, Hank. So he's an atheist and a utilitarian. And so I kind of go along to these Oxford lectures that Singer gives
really excited to kind of hear about ethics from an atheist perspective. But actually, I left that series of lectures with what I've described as a profound kind of intellectual vertigo, because basically what happens is that it's very clear. I mean, Singer's very consistent in his atheist ethics, and he just makes very, very clear, not only in those lectures, but then in the books that he writes as well, that really there is no kind of basis for thinking that human life is inherently valuable or precious or set apart from the animals in any way. So it's nothing distinctively valuable about human life. And moreover, in the rest of his kind of writings, which I then sort of after these lectures had to go and kind of familiarize myself with, because I found these claims so disconcerting, he really argues that there's no kind of equality, inherent equality of human life too. So Singer's well known for kind of arguing that human beings have a certain set of capacities that set them apart from the animals. But then the problem is, of course, if you don't have those capacities, so for example, the capacity to reason and to be self-conscious and to experience pain, to think of yourself as a being over time and so forth. But the problem is that if you don't have those capacities, so if you are severely disabled, a newborn infant with severe disabilities and no potential, therefore, to develop those capacities, then for Singer, your life is not nearly as worthy. I mean, to put it kind of in really stark terms, but the terms that Singer uses, like he argues for euthanasia of, he uses the term afterbirth abortion, like things that completely took the carpet from underneath me, as it were, gave me this kind of sense of intellectual vertigo. And the reason why I say that is that I guess the interesting thing is that even though I'd grown up in a non-Christian home, I basically, through osmosis, imbibed a set of Christian ethics, a set of Christian moral presuppositions about human life and human value. And what I realized after Singer's lectures, gradually and reading Singer's work, is that atheism actually doesn't sustain any of those deep ethical convictions about the value and the equality of human life. And so that kind of put me in an interesting kind of intellectual place as well. And then around the same time, so by this time, I'm in my mid-20s at Oxford, and there's kind of more, so there's kind of intellectual things and there are kind of personal things going on as well, in the sense that I kind of been living, well, in many ways, I kind of say this in the book when I open up sort of with a part of my testimony, I've been kind of living a kind of ahistorical life in a sense, in that I basically thought that life was about my own kind of self-invention, didn't really think that there was any greater story that I was part of. But then there's a sense in which even when things are going enormously well for you, and they were, like here I was at Oxford, I'd achieved this kind of childhood dreams I'd had as a young person in Australia, dreaming of going to Oxford and Cambridge, and I'd won scholarships and I'd done really well, and all these things seemed to be delivering, and yet there was this kind of sense that they were never enough. Like there was this kind of sense of spiritual, like emptiness, because I kind of knew that no matter how much I achieved, there was always a kind of sense that there was another rung on the ladder, as it were. And so I guess both personally and intellectually, I kind of found myself in my mid-20s in this place of just questioning, well, what is it that I live for? You know, and even as a historian now, kind of looking back, which I did a lot of reflecting to write Trees of History, and I think I kind of realized too that, you know, here's his, like the closest thing probably that I had to any kind of idol that I'd given my life to right before I knew Jesus is this kind of sense that I was a historian, like that's always what I was called to be. But then the thing is, if there's no kind of larger story that you're part of, no ultimate purpose to history, like what is history? And one of the reasons why I use the term priest of history in the title of my book is that Robert Boyle, who's now kind of like intellectually speaking, almost like an old friend spiritually and intellectually. But it strikes me that, you know, Boyle as a Christian had this sense of why his calling in life as a natural philosopher was something that he was called to do to glorify God. And it's why he uses the phrase a priest of nature for natural philosophers. And as a historian, part of what inspired Priest of History is the idea that I actually think that there's a reason that historians are actually, that we all actually, priesthood of all believers, are called to steward the past and to think of our responsibility towards God as stewarding the past. So anyway, I ended up as an assistant professor at Florida State University, and a friend of mine there gave me C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And that was probably the first time that I'd read a book that was actually about Christianity. before that, you know, there was a moment actually in Oxford where I found myself in the library over Christmas, and I, for the first time, was willing to kind of pick up a book of sermons and kind of read a book of sermons. And they made me kind of realize that this whole Christianity thing that I'd kind of dismissed, to be honest, in my arrogance, was far more intellectually robust and far more beautiful than I'd ever thought about. And actually, interestingly enough, one of the sermons that I read, yeah, quoted Psalm 39, where it talks about being fashioned together, knit together in the womb. So there was this alternative story really about who we are, you know, created by God and therefore given meaning in life by him. And I found that really striking. Again, it didn't make me a Christian. Here I am, you know, about a year later reading Me Christianity in Tallahassee. And then one morning I just kind of decided to rock up to church, kind of went by myself, rocked up to a church in Tallahassee. And I think the other thing that was happening there when I walked into church for the first time is that there was
this is the first time that you're in a church?
Not ever in my whole life, sorry.
Okay.
Somebody, it's really the first time that I had gone into a church kind of earnestly with an open mind, as it were, like really
searching.
Seeking God.
Yeah.
Yeah, searching. And I think the other thing that happens there is that they're celebrating the Lord's Supper that morning. Now, I'd never been baptized or christened, as it were, as a child, and so I didn't take part in the Lord's Supper. But it was clear that there was something transcendent, something sacred. And the liturgy, like the hymn by Ralph Vaughan Williams, who I was familiar with, like musically, and of course the words of being, of, you know, Christ's body broken for us and his blood poured out for the forgiveness of sins. Like there was a sense in which Christians were part of a people and a story. And that actually there was something which was sacred. Because this the other thing as an atheist. Like I was the kind of atheist that was really, like the philosophical term we kind of use for this is that I was metaphysically speaking a materialist. So what that meant was I didn't think, because why would you? Like if the only things that exist are matter in motion, like why would you think that there's anything outside of stuff, right, of matter in motion? But what happens in church, in the liturgy of the Lord's Supper, is that it's clear to me that, no, actually, the sort of sacredness and transcendence of God that I'd always kind of been yearning for was in some real sense on display for me. Like I was given a glimpse into a God who was transcendent and yet became human, and that was profoundly beautiful. At the same time, like I was reading T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, which, you know, Eliot has his own conversion story, and it's just, it's so profoundly moving, this kind of idea that God would become human and offer us like forgiveness for our sins and reconciliation with him. And so I became a Christian, like in my, started attending church, went to the catechism classes, and then, yeah, was baptized when I was 28. And I think even, you know, now kind of reflecting on that is, yeah, there's a kind of sense that the story God tells us in the Bible about who God is and who we are as human beings, that he is a God who is created the world, which is good, that we rejected him. Like as a historian, every civil, like I see that in history. That's profoundly true in history, right? Like you look at the history of human societies and civilizations, there is at once a kind of a yearning for the good society, an attempt to build it, but at the same time, a kind of rejection of God and a kind of fundamental brokenness of sin in the world. And that seemed to make, so the Bible story about who God is, that revelation made sense not only of world history and the human condition, but also it made sense of my own soul and my own yearning for forgiveness and reconciliation with God.
What an impact you are having, not only as a professor, but as a mother, as a Christian leader in many ways. I love what you say in your book, towards the end of the book, that Christianity is not only true, but it's also good and beautiful. And I think that's profound in so many different ways. I mean, I attend a church. It's not just four bare walls and a sermon, but you're enveloped in the architecture of the church, which is pointing towards the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, prepared as a bride, beautifully adorned for a husband, and an iconostasis that sees Christ on one side as coming in incarnation, the first advent, and then Christ in his second advent. And then you see the cross in between, how we're called to participate in the daily Advent, and part of that through the liturgical sacramental life of the church. But the beauty of the church, the beauty of architecture, but the beauty of the Word of God, the richness of people who have invested themselves in the Word of God. And you tell so many powerful stories in this book. And I was thinking as I was reading those stories that that is your secret sauce. You know, I was going to ask you, you know, how do you, is it really realistic to get people to read again in a digital age, in an age of computers and smartphones and all of that? But I think what you're doing is you're sort of intoxicating people with the stories of these people throughout history that made incredible impact. And a lot of them had absolutely nothing, and yet they transformed their world and vicariously ours.
Yeah, that's right. And there are so many stories, it's just that we don't, we often don't know about them. And yet, increasingly, you know, there are books out there which are starting to retell these stories and to make history much more accessible for people. And that can be really, really helpful, actually. Like one of the practices that we try to do quite a lot at home is like reading aloud at mealtimes. And so, yeah, actually reading books that aren't just the Bible, because trying to read them in such a way that we're like consciously with our kids or with whoever else is having dinner with us, bringing them, like making them know that this is, yeah, this particular part of history is actually part of their story too.
Yeah, your book is fantastic. And you're talking about in your book about reading the Bible at the dinner table and praying at the dinner table and the kind of practices you're involved in with your own children. I grew up in a Reformed context, and my parents, one of the things I remember most about my experience growing up, my parents never sat down for a meal without reading the Bible and praying. So even though I turned away from the faith because I just couldn't handle the whole idea of hard determinism, so for a while I turned away from the faith, but that practice of reading the Bible and praying at the dinner table is something that really motivated me later on in my life to memorize the Word of God, to meditate on the Word of God, to mine the Word of God for all its substantial wealth. So it laid a foundation for me, and I was so pleased to read in your book how you're inculcating those practices in your own family. It's not just something you're teaching, it's not ethereal for you, but this is really your way of life.
Yeah, and I think it's something that, you know, increasingly, even when you look at not just like the decline of reading, but even the decline of our ability to eat meals as people together, like regardless of whether it's your biological family or a much larger family, household, God's people, I think that practice of just like putting technology away and eating meals together, sharing fellowship, there's actually something deeply true to our own history as Christians doing that. Like even in the early church, some of the letters, even that like, so, you know, Pliny, the Roman governor, remarks upon when he's describing the Christians in the second century AD, he's recognizing that he describes the fact they meet together and they share a meal. Like this idea of sharing meals together, which often incorporated, a reading of the word or reading aloud, that is something that Christians have been practicing for centuries.
Yeah, talk to our audience as we close this podcast from your heart. Why you want them to be a priest of history? I mean, not talk to them collectively, but as you're talking to one person, why do you want the person that you have in your mind as you're speaking right now to be a priest of history?
Yeah. Well, gosh, you know, if you're somebody who is a follower of the Lord Jesus, then you are adopted into God's historical people. And you're part of that people's story in history, and you have that rich history available to you as a resource to help you as you follow the Lord in your faith. And so I would say to be a priest of history means to kind of steward the past in the same way that you would both kind of conserve the past and pass down these stories, but also kind of tend and keep and do that work of kind of uncovering lesser known stories, which we need to do from the past as well. And that kind of work, I think, can be so incredibly helpful for us as we seek to follow the Lord. I think it's helpful spiritually and intellectually, but I think it also helps us live as a people today, because we are not just individuals in the faith, we are part of God's people, the church. And so when we're united in the church and we can draw upon that vast treasury, as Isaac Watts put it so beautifully, I think we can just be so much better equipped to serve God in the world.
Beautifully said. Dr. Sarah Irving Stonebreaker, this is an incredible book, Priests of History. Actually, my eldest son brought it to me, said, Dad, you got to read this book. And I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Thank you for writing it. And I want to say to everybody listening in, again, this book is available for those of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get it on the web at equip.org, equip.org, or write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Dr. Sarah, you are amazing. You're an amazing writer, an amazing person, an amazing mother. I'm just so impressed by your testimony and your brilliant admonition to all of us to be priests of history.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Hank. It was great, great conversation.
Well, it's a sincere pleasure. Thank you so much. And for everybody listening in, thank you for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged Podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast. So long for now.